Canada today represented by Simon Whitfield. He wears number 18.
It's a challenging course. It really showcases the best athletes in triathlon. The swim's rough swim. No holding back in the swim. There's no you have no weaknesses. The bike's a hard technical course. And the run's not just a flat track run. It's got some hills, and it's going to challenge people mentally.
They're going to get ready to go, and off they go. Looks like a clean start. Simon Whitfield is to the far left. He liked his position because he had clear water.
They swim up onto the ramp, and they begin removing their wetsuits as they make their way into the transition area. We talked yesterday about the crowds lining the course. Look at the size of these crowds. I would think there might even be an excess of the 500,000 people who watched the women's race yesterday.
Oh, you can't even hear down here. It's incredible. The people are going crazy.
And I believe that Simon Whitfield was in very good position as he came out of the water, and he had a transition time of 21 seconds, and the word is that he is in sixth place. So Simon Whitfield is right up there as they move on to Macquarie Street for this 40K bike race.
And there's Simon right in the middle.
In the middle of an accident, Simon Whitfield got tangled up, and Simon Whitfield is able to get his bike out of that accident that took place. Now, how much time was lost, we will not know until they come into the transition area. And this is where they move off the bikes and get set for the 10K run. Simon Whitfield in 17th place. He is a minute and 1 second back through the transition. So
that's
he lost some
spot.
Time, but not that badly considering the accident.
Oh, that's actually a miracle for him to still be in 17th spot, only 1 minute back from the leaders. It could be a three-person race to the finish here. Simon Whitfield just put his foot in front, moving into first position. There's three of them right there. They're going to battle the end. We've got just over a kilometer and a half to go. Simon Whitfield has put himself in a position for a medal, possibly even a gold.
And Whitfield continues to hang in there just a couple of steps behind Vukovic.
Now, Vukovic went out pretty hard, too, on the run. We'll see if that cost him here. Simon's thinking about that. Well, Vukovic doesn't want to take any chances. He's decided to take his kick now. Is it too early? We don't know. We'll see if he fades. Whitfield has let him go. Whitfield has the capability to stay with him. This is part of his strategy. He's let Vukovic go to see if he's gone too early. He'll try and reel him in as they get closer.
They are now moving close to the finish line.
Simon's making his move. He's trying to reel him in. It's getting closer.
They are going to run under the steps of the Opera House, and Simon Whitfield seems to be gaining ground with every stride. Simon Whitfield is sprinting towards the finish line, trying to haul in Vukovic. Simon Whitfield is coming at him. Simon Whitfield is going ahead. Simon Whitfield has moved into the lead. Simon Whitfield racing to the finish line. This 25-year-old from Kingston, Ontario, so relaxed and composed this morning. He was signing autographs, laughing and talking to the spectators, and he is going to win the gold medal. Canada, Simon Whitfield, gold. Vukovic is going to finish in second place, and Simon Whitfield has provided Canada with its first gold medal at the Olympic Games as the sport of triathlon makes its debut. What an amazing win for Simon Whitfield, who came so close to disaster on the cycling course.
Gold medal, Simon Whitfield. How does that sound?
Unbelievable. I dreamed of this my entire life. I dreamed about winning a gold medal, and it happened today. And I can't tell you how proud I am and how proud I am to be Canadian.
On the show today, four-time Canadian Olympic triathlete Simon Whitfield, here to talk about his Olympic journey and what it took for him to win two medals, 14 world titles, and 12 national championships, as well as life lessons learned through it all.
Listening to the Run Your Life podcast with host Andy Vassily.
As a young boy, Simon Whitfield loved playing team sport, in particular soccer and ice hockey. and through these pursuits, he was able to develop important skills that would go on to serve him well in the future. However, it was the sport of running that really captured his interest, inspiring him to think about what was possible in his life and to dream big. He has nothing but fond memories when he reflects on his first time being introduced to triathlon, getting his start in the Charbot Lake Kids Triathlon, which was an informal, family-friendly, community-based event. He fell in love straight away with triathlon, and in order to become the very best that he could be, he said his goodbyes to his family and friends and left his home in Kingston, Ontario, to travel alone as a 16-year-old more than halfway across the world to Sydney, Australia, to complete high school and to train amongst Australia's top-ranked triathletes. As a father myself to two boys, 15 and 17 years old, Eli and Ty, they're both really passionate about sport. Ty, the 15-year-old, loves soccer, plays it competitively, and Eli is really passionate about golf. And when I think about their journeys, in my heart, I can't imagine what it would be like for them to travel more than halfway across the world to try to develop their skills further and to compete at more of an elite level. So I can't imagine that. But obviously, Simon was really driven, and he was very much a part of the decision to go abroad to become the best athlete that he could become. And this decision would obviously pay off for Simon and help spur him on to Olympic greatness. You'll really hear how he achieved the things that he did in our discussion today. But in this episode, Simon in particular shares the role that visualization played in the process of winning his gold medal in the 2000 Sydney Games, as well how it always helped him to create and play out different scenarios in his head in order to always be ready for anything that happened in competition. And you'll see in this episode today that Simon really is a deep thinker and very reflective, and he speaks with authenticity and genuinely expresses himself in an open way, and I really appreciate that. He shares in our discussion what he feels he has learned about himself, not only through success, but also through hardship and adversity. And it's these life lessons that continue to propel Simon on his own journey, inspiring him to find meaning and purpose in his life that extend far beyond his identity as a world-class athlete and Olympian to something that means so much more to him. The ability to always remain open and curious about the world and to always connect with nature. To be out on the ocean as a certified paddleboard instructor and ultimately to give back to his sport and to the younger generation of athletes striving to follow in his footsteps. It was wonderful to have this discussion with Simon today, and it is my hope that wherever you are in the world listening to this, that you find inspiration in his story and the lessons he shares in our conversation. Thanks for listening, and with that, let's jump right into Simon talking about early days in his life. Just take it away.
Sure. Simon Whitfield, I live in Victoria, British Columbia. In a past life, as I alluded to, I went to four Olympic Games and medaled twice. Won a gold medal in Sydney at the 2000 Olympics and a silver medal at the 2008 Beijing Olympics. I was the flag bearer for Canada at the closing ceremonies in Sydney, and 12 years later was the opening ceremonies flag bearer. And both those things were quite impactful as at the time they just happened. You know, and now years later, I realize just how impactful they were. So yeah. That's me.
And we're going to unpack a lot of that journey today and some of your accomplishments and the things you've done. But I really want to start with early days. And, you know, I've done a lot of reading about your life. And from what I understand, you were involved in team sport from an early age. So you played soccer and hockey. Can you give us a time frame of when this was But more specifically, when you first started to explore running as an individual pursuit in your life, and when you think about running, when did you know that you were onto something special, and how did you know it?
So I grew up playing classic Canadian hockey, ice hockey in the winter, soccer in the summer. I came from that kind of, athletic background. I moved to more to endurance sport as it was kind of where my aptitude was and truly what I love to do. I love sports. I love games, but I think I was suited to running long errands, which is essentially what endurance sport is. I grew up with a real focus on, as I said, to soccer, hockey, and that suited me later. I had an athleticism. I think that some of my competitors, maybe they had bigger diesel engines. They had specificity from swimming, biking, and running from an earlier age than I did. But I had that general fitness, and I had an athleticism that enabled me to not only understand a different perspective on the tactics and the strategies that one might use, as I came from some team sports where you had to think in that manner a little differently. I also think it just gave me an athleticism that meant that if I crashed, I didn't crash all that hard. I seemed to be able to pick up the skills quickly. And I think that that came from having a kinesthetic awareness that was inherited from a mom who taught gymnastics and a dad who, mom and dad who encouraged my sister and I to get into a lot of different sports. The transition though, the shift, I saw Kevin Sullivan, who's a Canadian middle distance Olympian. When I was in grade 8, I was running with the high school. So I was in last year middle school, but I was invited to do a year to run with and try out for the team as kind of I wasn't allowed to compete at the championships, but I was allowed to attend their events. And I went to Brampton and I watched this guy that was just a year older than I was compete race. So he's in grade 9 racing with the grade 12s. And I watched him before the race. I wasn't racing, so I got to just take it all in. And it had a huge impact on me. It's just seeing this guy, just the way he carried himself, the way he just prepared, the confidence that he had, and the way he wasn't intimidated by going out racing with, guys that were 3 years older than him and going and laying a whooping to him. And so that moment, I got asked recently, kind of those inspirations that stories other people may not know. And that was one of them for me. And I think that the bus ride home became, at that time, it was very overwhelming to be in grade 8 and being with a high school student. Mm-hmm. So you're looking for allies, you're looking for mentors. My very good friend's older brother was on the team, so I had a little bit in there. But I spent a lot of time on the bus just staring out the window, pretending to run beside it, keeping up with the bus. Mm-hmm. And that little skill, that like little exercise, stuck with me my whole career. If I was on the plane, if we were in the transfer from the airport to the hotel, I was always looking out the window and just imagining myself running, down the sidewalk, over that alley, parkour before it was parkour kind of thing, in my imagination, I could jump big hedges and tall hedges and big ditches. And that set me up for an athletic career in triathlon because I loved it, because it was a family festival atmosphere. I was just blessed with parents that really emphasized with my sister and I the joy of sport. The unconditional support wasn't conditional on a result. It was conditional on effort. And all those things become almost cliche, but they're just so true, And so I realized later, I think I didn't realize at the time, but I can think through now, is that that just gave me this freedom that a lot of athletes didn't have. They were there thinking about results. I was there thinking about expressing hard work. Mm-hmm. I could never articulate it at that time like that, but that's what it was, it was just unconditional support, unconditional love of doing it.
When you started off, so you started off as a runner, right? Or did you jump into triathlon right away? My understanding is you started off with running and then you found triathlon. There was the Hollywood couple, them. So they were the ones that kind of introduced you to the sport. Or can you share a little bit about your transition into triathlon from strictly running?
Yeah, that's a fun story for me. Imagine being, you're starting to understand and hear about the sport. Your friends are doing it. You're loving swimming. You're loving being on the bike. And then it turns out that these people you meet through it, I think through running, I think we met them at the Hollywoods through running, and they had us all up at their cabin on Charbert Lake. And this is the great Ontario experience, you know. Yeah. You're at the lake in the summer. Yeah. There's an old telephone pole being stretched out over the lake, and you're leaping off it on. And at some point in all that, you someone says, "Hey, do you think you could swim to the store and get the milk?" You know. Right. So we said, "Yeah, of course we can." And so yeah, I thought that was 7 kilometers at the time. I think years later we measured it out to be about 2 kilometers, but yeah, whatever, you know, details. And so I did it just because Brendan was doing it. The family organized it. It sounded fun. Mm-hmm. And right away it was like, wait a minute, this is it. Like, I get to hang out with my folks on the weekend and be at a festival of sport and be ridiculous, like run around in my Speedos, which is just ridiculous in this arbitrary made up thing. And truly, it's become cliche for me, but my favorite triathlon will always be the bobsleigh triathlon, which was a swim from here to over there-ish and back. Yeah. You weren't allowed out of the water until the last person was out of the water. It was a ride around the lake. You weren't allowed out of onto the run until the last person's off the bike, and a run to the end of the lane. And that is triathlon. The blue carpet, the big scene, the big scenarios, whatever it is, big races. That's cool. Love it. Like, amazing. But at the end of the day, it's just this ridiculous grassroots sport where, you know, it's like I said at the intro, you're kind of become the guy that's really good at running long errands. You know, swim, bike, or run your package to you. So I kind of joke I'd be a good FedEx guy.
Yeah. Well, it sounds obviously like social connection played a big part of what you did, and having that community and that support base obviously propelled you on to think about what's possible. And, you know, from what I understand, you have a strong connection with Australia. And I didn't know this about your story until I started to dig into it a little more. And I think a lot of people probably don't know your Australia connection. But can you just talk about that strong connection you had with Australia growing up, and that you actually moved there in high school to take your triathlon training to a deeper level? So what I'm curious about, when I think of my own boys, 15, 17 years old, I couldn't imagine them leaving, you know, to pursue something like that, you know. So that I'm just wondering what it was like for you as a, I don't know how old you were, 15 or 16, but what emotions did you experience leaving the home, you know, your home in Kingston for the first time, moving more than halfway around the world to pursue mastery of your craft?
I was enamored with all things Aussie when I was a kid. My dad's an Aussie. He's an Aussie, you know. Yeah. He didn't get his Canadian citizenship until last year. So he lived in Canada for 50 odd years and got it last year. So he's Aussie. And if you spend time in Australia, and especially particularly going to a boarding school like I did, the Aussies, there's some parts that can grate you, you know. There's some incredible pieces to that Aussie culture. I went there enamored. I came back with a greater appreciation of Canada. I went to a boarding house that was at the time overtly racist. It was the attitude, the tolerance of jokes that I grew up in Kingston with. Luckily, Kingston's a fairly multicultural town. I grew up with a Japanese guy, an Egyptian guy. You know, I didn't think anything of it at the time, but when I got to Australia, I definitely thought about it. I was like, wow, this is not okay. And that piece just affected me in terms of that time, you know. It made me really appreciate something about, by no means in Canada are we anywhere near perfect, but my experience in Kingston was different than that day of the Aussie kid, who there was a real delineation between Aussie and from other, you know. And that, why I say that is that, like I said, I went there thinking Aussie, 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 came home thinking, okay, wait a minute, I'm Canadian. Mm-hmm. It affected me quite deeply, I think. Again, it's not things you realize until many years later, but it, in a very positive way, it made me very resilient to, you know, I arrived in Sydney as a 16-year-old with a couple bags, arrived at the airport, had the wrong instructions on how to get to the school, so got lost on the way there. And every person I met was, I'd met for the first time. I lived in random, you know, people's houses in the summer breaks between boarding school. And I, so I met a lot of great friends and I was exposed to sport at a very high level. The family I stayed with when I first arrived in Australia was the Dunn family, and Matt Dunn swam for Australia at the Olympics and was this great IMer. And I stayed in his room and amongst all these medals, you know, so he's 4 or 5 years older than I am. He's been just come from the school I'm going to. He swam in the lane I'm in. And there I am in his room looking at all his medals, you know, and years later, and his two younger brothers or twin brothers and my, you know, they're taking me under their wing, playing cricket with me in the hallway. That was just very impactful in both those ways, but also it affected me, you know. One of the ways I think you cope with that, and you alluded to it, when you have 16-year-olds, I've got a 14-year-old and 11-year-old. And again, as you just said, like, man, imagine those kids just take up to this other world. It hardens you in a way, it detaches you in a way from your emotions on that. And that affected me. I didn't really think of it. I thought of that as being a dedication, frankly. I thought of it as being the necessary sacrifice. And I realized that it disassociated me from things like Christmas, from family occasion, from birthdays, because it became very difficult. This is before internet, FaceTime, this is like, use your calling card and use it sparingly. So the only way you cope with that is to just, for me, was to disassociate a bit, to step back and be like, yeah, I don't do Christmases. I don't do holidays. You know, I just train. And at the time that was very effective for training, but it took years, I realized, to reconnect. I stayed in touch with my folks, but in the manner that I, you know, I never came home again. I left at 16 and I'm 47. So I think for now, having daughters, I think, oh man, my parents, the courage, not only to let your son, to send your son off, you know, but also to not step in and try and get him to come home. You know, they really just supported. Yeah. They didn't say, oh man, love you, be back here. Like, I mean, maybe they didn't want me to be there. they really supported that. And
but did that experience, Simon, did that experience allow you to just dive, you know, right into the deep end of training and to separate yourself and develop that laser sharp focus on what you needed to do?
Absolutely. My dad's a scientist, and that's he operated. He just got into things and didn't get distracted and got it done. And I had that aspect to me too. So that played to my strengths. Now, I did pay a price for that. I think our family paid a bit of a price for that in that connection, you know, and being on the other side of the country still, especially as you come through something like we've come through with this pandemic and you go like, oh, I can't even go visit you right now. So I've worked really hard to reestablish that connection in a more, I take the time now. I really I connect with them as much as I can, because I do. And part of that is just realizing the sacrifice it took on their part to send their son off, and that it's just like, you know, seeing your kid like, oh, good, I hope you're okay. Like, call any time. But again, it also meant that I had this real belief, I still do, that the athlete that wins thinks about it. And we call it N plus one, one more time than anyone else thinks about it.
Yeah.
When you're there and everything's on the line, you're away from your family, I had support. I mean, I've lived a privileged upbringing to be able to even be sent away like that and have those opportunities, but to actually then honor it and work and work and work and be just, I was just relentless in that. That big part of it was that I'd made all these other sacrifices, and that became part of it for me. And I think other athletes allude to this too, that when you start to realize that what you're really training for is the last, you're always training to maintain propriety of breath, right? You're the last one to flinch. And part of that last one to flinch is that as you're having that conversation with yourself at the end, when it's you beside somebody else, you're having this conversation of justification. Can I do this? Is it worth it? Have I made enough sacrifice? And so the sacrifices you make, you start to realize before that in your preparation, the more sacrifices you make, the easier that conversation will be with 1K to go. Because you'll be like, oh my goodness, I didn't do all this. I didn't sacrifice all those things to get here to give up now. And so I operated on that premise a lot. I was like, I had a strange, you know, I skipped a lot of things that other people went to because I was like, well, I'm training. And they're like, really? Like, you can't just go for it. And I'm like, and part of me knew that if I did that, then I was putting myself in a position where I put more onto it. You know, I have more chips in this than you do.
Yeah. You know, Simon, what's amazing about what you just said is, you know, a little bit of inner voice there, the power of inner voice. And the one thing that I wanted to ask you about, and before asking you this, I just want to share a little bit of a story. Do you know Dr. Jim Lohr? He's a sports psychologist. He was recently on a podcast that I listened to. And the title of the podcast is literally Mental Toughness, Energy Management, and the Power of Journaling. He's worked with 17 world number ones in their craft, like, you know, Nadal, tennis player, and Sampras, and like just a multitude of elite athletes. And in particular, he worked with Dan Jansen, the speed skater. Mm-hmm. And Dan's got an amazing story of, you know, a lot of people, when they think of Dan, they think of all the times he choked before actually winning his gold medal. And when he represented US as a speed skater, his sister, I think this was the 84 Olympics maybe, but his sister had just passed away from cancer. And he was going to go home to his family. And his family said to him, she would have wanted you to stay and race the 500 and the 1000. And he didn't really want to stay, but he did. And he obviously wanted to win gold in her honor. And he crashed in both races, you know? So that stayed with him. And he created this inner narrative, this personal narrative, was that he can't handle the pressure. And he kept stumbling in the Olympics and not fulfilling his potential. So then he started to work with Jim Lohr, and Jim Lohr made him reframe his personal narrative and begin with his inner voice. And here's a quote from Jim Lohr. He says, the power broker in your life is the voice that no one hears. How well you revisit the tone and content of your private voice is what determines the quality of your life. It is the master storyteller, and the stories we tell ourselves are our reality. So he got Dan Jansen to not hate the 1,000 meters because Dan Jansen said, I'm not an endurance skater. I'm a sprint skater. And Jim said to him, no, you're going to love the 1,000 meters. We're going to change your narrative. And then finally, Dan goes out in his last Olympics, last race, and wins the gold medal. So it's a testament to the power of inner voice. And what I want to ask you, because you just touched upon that, I want to ask you about your own inner voice as an elite athlete and to take us through what your inner voice was like early in your career and how this inner voice may have changed with experience and wisdom. And in particular, how did you learn to navigate your inner voice in extreme pressure-filled situations and moments of failure? And people listening, what is your advice to people listening, pursuing both personal and professional excellence in their life when it comes to developing a more positive, empowering inner voice?
I mean, he nailed it with that quote, didn't he? That's that, that internal narrative that informs our whole worldview. It's also fair to say, too, that it changes over time, isn't it? And it changes not just in times as in big scale, but also in the day, during the day. I think upon reflection that I had, because I was self-regulating with exercise and this very strict routine and I never broke, you know, when I say never, I really like very rarely stepped away from, it also managed my inner voice in a better way. You know, it had an outlet. It had just a physical chemical outlet. So it was predicated on that. It wasn't necessarily, I was journaling, sure I was doing a lot of those inner monologues that you're alluding to, this visualization, this inner dialogue. I think at the end of the day, though, that it was regulated by just the simple act of, you know, getting up in the morning and going to the pool and being wholly, solely focused on that. So I would have described myself, and this is all 2020 hindsight. I mean, I don't know if this is, if we could be a fly on the wall and go back there, maybe I was much more negative than I'm about to portray, but I feel like I had a very positive and imaginative narrative. I played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons as a kid. And Andre and I have thought up incredible worlds and built all the little details. And we had this incredible capacity to imagine. And that, I brought that to Draftlon. I brought that to visualizing how races would go, to thinking outside the box around the preparation, the specific tactics, the narrative of controlling how other people talked about the race. I knew, I understood a lot of that stuff quite intuitively. And why I say that I was back then is that what has certainly changed for me over the years since I retired has been this like arrival of a much more critical harsh inner voice. I've thought to myself, geez, when did this guy arrive? You know, what happened here? And I could trace it back a lot of personal stuff that I'd just keep to myself. But I think that that's had a very telling, impactful impact on my life, not just my career, but my life in the last, since I've retired. I also feel though that I've come to accept and explore a bit the aspect of that the struggle is just part of it, you know, that we starting to that time. So you frame it as just happiness as being the key. And I'll share this ridiculous story, but I love what happened is I was at the Ontario or the BC Science Center with my kids. We're walking up the ramp into the IMAX dome. This little kid is running down the ramp. Really, it can't be. It's a toddler. It barely can run. It just wipes out. Boom! Slides across the carpet right in front of us. And the mom just walks by and says, and the kid just, ah! And I'm sitting there with my kids and I'm kind of holding them like, oh, are you okay? And the mom just says, hey, kiddo, the struggle is real. And I laughed so hard inside, but I also just loved the way she rolled with it. She did it. Her kid just got up and got going again. And I said to my kids, like, that was awesome. That right there. If you learn anything from mom and dad, it's composure. And also, like, the struggle is real. Don't expect this to be Kumbaya and campfire songs, but I got you. And your mom's got you. And that mom had her, like, she lifted her up. She got her back on her feet, got it going. And that little piece I've taken for myself, not just for my children, but for myself, is to, when the struggle gets, when that inner narrative starts really rolling on me, is to just kind of lean into it a little bit and go, okay, I'm not going to be afraid of these demons in the dark. I'm going to go shine a flashlight on them, because at their source, their message, if you can weed through all the other shit, is poignant and it's right and it's real and it's like a truth to you. And I found in those moments, sometimes I like call them inconvenient truths. Or, you know, the truth is a bully we all pretend to love.
Yeah.
I heard that in a yoga class and I was like, you know, you're in that state. And I was like, that thing. Yes. Right. That's it. We pretend like, oh man, tell me the truth. I want to hear the truth. And then you tell you the truth. And sometimes you go, I don't want to hear that. Embracing that a little bit, not managing expectations around that, not expecting everything to be the truth that we just love to hear. I think that is, you know, is the, how I navigate. I was about to say, save me from, there's no, ain't no saving you from. It's just one day at a time, but navigating that is there's a couple different things of, I really like the idea of it's so simple. Keep walking, you know, just like it's all good. You'll be fine. Just keep walking. Go in the hallway, walk. Go inside, walk. Keep walking. And that struggle is a real piece of just being okay with that. And it's like, you know, as it's being well pointed out in the society you live in now, that as someone like me who grew up white kid, privileged, middle class, educated parents, had every opportunity in the world. So there's a fine line between when someone like I say, oh, my struggle is real. And someone else says, that's great. Like, was your struggle real when your parents flew you off to Australia as a little kid? Was your struggle real when you got to be, to spot, you know, sponsored and Sure. Like that, relative to others, I've had a very lot of privilege, but at the end of the day, I still lie in bed like everybody else at 2 o'clock in the morning. What the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
What is happening? And I'm not going to say embracing that, but just not having expectations that it's going to be different. And seeing that side of life as being just as important and as fulfilling and as real as the other parts that makes those joyous moments. Like, I pay attention now. My kids are doing something, I pay attention. When they're like, when they say, "Hey Dad, can you go play pickleball?" I drop what I'm doing and I go play pickleball, because I really, that part is not the struggle. That is just like the good shit. Yeah. And so that served me well. So in the long-winded answer all the way back to that is I had a vivid imagination as a racer, and I had generally positive self-talk. I talked myself into expecting to be at the front and expecting to be part of the race and dictating the race to others.
Yeah.
And that served me at the time.
And what, you know, everything that you just talked about, I can map on that in multiple ways. And my wife is doing some pretty intensive work with Dr. Gabor Mate. He is a, Dr. Gabor Mate. So she just finished his year-long training in compassionate inquiry. So she's worked really in depth with some of these things. And the first thing Gabor says is, you can't compare trauma, you know, and I'm not saying you experience trauma. I'm just saying in general, one person cannot compare their life experiences to another, because, you know, somebody might have gone through so much shit in their life and another person may have lived a privileged life, but you can't compare their lives, you know, so there's no comparison of people's life, because it's all contextual. And it's learning to sit with these uncomfortable emotions. And there's a story of the Buddha who is sitting with uncomfortable emotions. And I heard this story, and it's really fascinating. And the story is that he invites this demon figure into his life. The demon figure is called Mara. And, you know, so instead of fighting these emotions, he says that he would invite Mara in for tea. And he would sit with Mara every day and say, "What are you here to teach me?" And that's what Gabor Mate says about our trauma and the things we've gone through, is that they're there to teach us something about ourselves. When we reconnect with our essence, then we are reconnecting with what matters to us and our story, and to provide us with what we need to move forward in positive ways. And in an interview that I heard, you talked about this kind of empty space and the space between. And that's really special to me, because that's all mindfulness. And, you know, I know that you have a love and passion of the outdoors, whether it be paddleboarding or training, whatever. Well, before, when you were training, and that sport has always been a way to express yourself, and there's great theater in it. But when you reflect on your own learning over the years, and you think about that empty space, or the space between, Viktor Frankl, famous Austrian psychiatrist and psychotherapist, Man's Search for Meaning, he has a quote. And when I think of your story, I think of this quote, in particular, the space between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space is the power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. And I think of all of your endless hours of training, and each stride you took in every race and every practice, each pedal stroke of the bike, each freestyle stroke in the water, so much time, so much space in between, you know? So when you hear Viktor Frankl's quote, what resonates with you in regards to your own learning and your own growth, where you're at in your life now, what you've learned about yourself as an elite athlete, and just in general, how does that resonate with you?
I mean, it took me right away to playing tennis this morning. My play with the Zhao, he's moved here, him and his family just moved here from China. And we play once a week, we play three times a week. And we never take score. We never play for anything, but each point just for a moment matters, you know? And we were talking today about trying to hit these flat shots, what do you call it? Flight shots that don't, no topspin, no nothing. And then there was a moment today where I'm struggling with it, and then, you know, I did it. And that's that space in between. There's like this moment where if everything just went silent, and the ball, I watched it, I could see the seam, I could see it coming to me. And I was like, oh, and I hit a tunk. As soon as I made the connection and followed through, I just watched it and I could see that the seam spinning. And I was about for a split second, time just stopped. And we both afterwards, I can't even remember, like, who cares who won the point. There's no winning your points for us, just whatever the ball ended up. And then he tapped his racket and then we both laughed. And then we moved on to the next thing. And I like, what I love about that is nothing in that moment, nothing else was going on. I think I was like, just this entity connecting with this other entity. Yeah. I think that piece right there, if you trace back to winning in Sydney and performing at other races, those moments, they were the space in between. There was the inner dialogue was quiet. Mm-hmm. The implications of were gone. There wasn't consequence. There wasn't narrative. There was nothing. There was mm-hmm. just like the joy of doing it. Not even the joy of doing it, just doing it. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, I read The Last Neanderthal by Claire Cameron. She's a Toronto author. It's a most incredible book. And there's a lot in there about this Neander state with a smaller prefrontal cortex, this huge intuitive capacity. And I read that and I thought, hey, I'm a little Neander, you know, yeah. when I can get out of my own way. And I'm not going to say, if you're trying to shut up the inner voice, you're acknowledging your voice, you know, you've put a muzzle on that. So just letting go of all that, that in the book, Stealing Fire, they call it.
Stephen Kotler or Stephen. Yeah, he's awesome.
Ecstasius, you know, it's the space between ecstasy and that moment of stealing fire from the gods, that moment when everything just stops and the personalities and the stories you're telling yourself are all gone.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but just I want to tag on that because I just finished reading The Art of Impossible by Kotler. So I'm thinking about signing up for one of his programs. But what he talks about is like the latest research into flow and being in the zone. Really, the prefrontal cortex is shut down. Prefrontal cortex is the self-judging, self-critical voice. And they've proven through multiple experiments that the prefrontal cortex shuts down. So there is no inner critic anymore. You're just doing. You're reacting in response. So I just wanted to say that, but continue on with what you were saying.
Well, that's it. You just nailed it. That's perpetual presence, a deep sense of now. They're all terms that we've we've assigned to it, but it's true. It's just that I keep saying to Zhao that playing tennis is like hitting. It's just like surfing. It's a bit of a strange crossover, you know, one with a racket, one with a surfboard. But there's that moment surfing where you're just drifting. You're not doing anything. Mm. You're just standing there for a moment, and that this momentum takes you, and you've overcome fear and all those other things, and you're just there.
Yeah.
And the same, sometimes, you know, you hit the tennis ball just right, hit the sweet spot. You just know as you hit it, you're like, oh, that's going to be hard to return. And you're not even thinking that, you're just hitting the tennis ball. Those are what I play for now. That's what the same message I give my kids. That's when I listen to athletes talk about their preparation. That's what I'm listening for. Are they talking about the, as in the ramifications of it, all prefrontal cortex just yammering away at them. This is about that. This is about this. And this is your value in that. Or have they created somewhat of an avatar where they're just like, I don't know. I just done a bunch of preparation. Let's see how this goes. And I think that I just touched on something that I think. So when Andre and I played Dungeons and Dragons, you know what it was at the end of the day? It was funny. We had came up with funny plot lines. We came up with fun characters. We had a great laugh. All the other things that came of it were peripheral to the fact that it was fun. It was like humorous. It was joyous. And when I think about, you know, my partner Tamara, why do we spend time together? Because she's the funniest person I know. There are all these other things. She's brilliant, smart. She's a terrific athlete, et cetera, et cetera. But you know what I love about her? If I was stuck upside down in a hole, I'd want to be stuck upside down with her because she's funny. Mm. She would make that time pass. And I think that as much as, you know, we're alluding to this idea of silencing your inner self and all those things, but there's something to be said for humor is also pathos. That's the pathetic nature of everything. It's ridiculous, you know? And so once you acknowledge that, than in particularly in triathlon, this hilarious, you know, conglomerate of sports, running long errands. You recognize the pathos in it, the pure ridiculousness of it that enables you to see it as funny, which somewhere in there just enables your brain to your prefrontal cortex to kind of let go of the narrative, what this is consequential to, because you just think, well, it doesn't really matter. So I just want to just go do it. And that's what I love, you know, that's what I strive for now. That's what I spend my time doing. I love playing soccer with the boys because I like connecting with the boys. I don't really care if we win.
Going back to that social connection. And when I think of some of the things you just talked about, I think of obviously as a elite athlete, you know, you have a responsibility to mentor, but you're also mentored. And a couple of days ago, I reached out to Adam Campbell and I told him that I was going to be talking to you. So for the listeners, Adam was on, we did a two-part series a couple of years ago. Adam is a really special guy. And we really, even though we had these two episodes, it was probably 4 hours of recording, because maybe it was because he grew up as a third culture kid in Nigeria. We really connected. And I really, in his story, I saw my story of like being abroad. And but for the listeners, Adam is a professional ultra marathoner and a ski mountaineer who's been through a lot in his life. It's extraordinary what he's been through, and he embodies resilience every day. But I asked him to say a few words about you, so I want to share that with you. Then I do have a question for you. But what Adam said was, Simon was and remains a massive inspiration of mine. His win at the 2000 Olympics inspired me as a young athlete, as it did many others, and opened up a whole world of endurance sport to me. He motivated me to explore my potential as an athlete. And since then, Simon has gone on from being an idol to a great friend. He continues to inspire and push me to explore the limits in all areas of my life and to stay curious about the world. He has also had my back through many major life events. And for that, I am eternally grateful to him. And I think those are really special words that kind of encapsulate the impact that you've had on others, in particular Adam, because in our podcast, he actually talked about you quite a bit. So I want to ask you about the idea of being mentored, but also mentoring. And what is your advice to others who are listening to this podcast, whether they are being mentored by someone or they are mentoring other people? What can they do to be more successful within their role? And how does vulnerability and authenticity factor into the process of being mentored or mentoring others?
Adam said that. That's lovely. You know, I think the world, Adam, is one of my closest friends. We have been through a lot recently, not recently, together. Yeah. I share that admiration of what he's done and what he's accomplished and the way he goes about it. But that last piece there, the vulnerability, that's what really stands out with Adam, is he just has this incredible courage to not only go do things, but to share it. I don't have that anymore. I share here, but I don't put out as much stuff as Adam does that's so heartfelt and has having such a great, you know, an impact on people. In terms of that mentoring piece, I don't know the answer to that. I was very diligent at, I understood early on that those mentors were important. And I think if you asked, it's kind of funny, if someone asked Hamish Carter what his first impression of me was, Hamish won in 2004, the Olympic Games. He was in triathlon. He was from New Zealand. And one of the things I remember him saying early on to me, I was asking him some questions. He goes, how do you not know this? I said, what do you mean? He was like, you're asking me some questions that made me wonder if you're like, how did you get this far? And I said, oh, dude, I know some, I know these answers. I'm also willing, and I was always willing to just start from zero. And so I which put me in a place where Greg Bennett, who's a legend of triathlon, and Chris McCormack, who won multiple Ironman Hawaii's, and Craig Alexander, who did the same, and McKeely Jones, and Nicole Spirig. I went to them and asked them questions. And a lot of times they were my peers, you know, they were my close friends. And yet I still sat down and said, hey, why are you doing that bike thing? What's up with that run? What's with nutrition? And I didn't always find that people asked me that same, I didn't necessarily feel that that was always back and forth, but I didn't care. I just was like, well, I'm just going to gather information. Maybe that's my dad's science background. In terms of mentoring, mentoring quite difficult. I think you see it as something you're going to do, or you respond once you've been through the experience of having mentors, and then you're in a position where people might want you to mentor them. You think, oh yeah, sure, I can do that. And you think, oh, this can be a pretty straightforward journey. It's not. It's really, I've had every realm of experience in that, from like, oh man, that didn't go well. not just with them, but just like our relationship, mm-hmm. our friendship. Like, what happened here? Can we just go back to hitting tennis balls?
Yeah.
So I've overreached in that capacity. I've overreached as in I've like gone in and tried to like fix something, yeah. or like I've got caught in that savior position where you're like, I can fix this. I'm a savior of this. I'm a savior here. I've been in that position. So I go into it now with a different, trying to have a different attitude to it. I'm more of just, I don't even know. Just
is
like
it like unlocking internal resources within people? Because what you're saying is like, you have to read the people, you have to know them, you have to know when to step in, you know, have to know when to take on more of a consulting coaching role as opposed to learning alongside them. Is it a variety of things, do you think?
I think it's all comes down to the same thing for all of us in any relationship. It's how do you do this and maintain a power equity?
Yeah.
How do you sit together where at the end of the day, at the start of the day and at the end of the day, you meet on equal, on neutral terms. Mm-hmm. You're not, and often in that mentor role, there's an immediate kind of shift of, oh, so, you know, I'm going to bequeath you with my expertise, you know, yeah. that would be the extreme of it. And as soon as that happens, there's this imbalance. So I'm learning now that there always has to be that, it's cliche, but there's that mutual respect and that like that lack of a power imbalance, or those things, they start okay, but they don't end okay. And also just the real acknowledgement straight up the top that it's a mutual benefit, mm-hmm. that this idea, well, I will do this for you. I will mentor, you know, that would be the extreme of that. That does not work. That has to be a real genuine appreciation of the fact that as you're in this, maybe you're answering more questions than you're asking. You're also exploring within yourself the answers, the reasons for things. Mm-hmm. And that piece has its own value and is therefore of its value to you to do. And it should, in theory, balance out that relationship to understanding it's not one person doing something for someone else. It's this mutual connection and sharing. And you said it, the vulnerability. Mm-hmm. That's ultimately everything, isn't it? We start with mutually assured destruction. And from there, someone says, at some point you say, okay, I'll tell you what, I'll spend a moment here where I'm going to be vulnerable. And if you, in the grandest scheme, if you like take advantage of that, that's what happens. So anytime we open our mouth, we're vulnerable.
Yeah. But you know, what's really interesting is I had Anthony Calvillo on the podcast about a month ago. You know, Anthony Calvillo wins 3 Grey Cups and
all-time
leading passer, right? And he really opened up in that episode where he shared, because I asked him something not similar, but we just got on the topic of what did he learn when he, because he was drafted by Las Vegas Posse, the first U.S. expansion team in the CFL. And then Hamilton picked him up and brought him in the expansion draft up to Hamilton. So he goes in there, Mike Kerrigan, experienced CFL quarterback, and another experienced quarterback. And then he wins the starting position, Anthony, in his first year. So he's 24 years old. He's starting quarterback of Hamilton. And in that moment, he said that because he had won the starting spot, he didn't think that Kerrigan had anything to offer him. But also he admitted that for 4 friggin' years, he never asked a question to a coach or another quarterback, veteran quarterback. And the reason why, and he was willing to admit it, was for fear of looking stupid.
Right.
He grew up as a kind of like a special needs student, a student that was struggling in school because of his life situation, not because he wasn't smart.
Yeah.
So he always feared looking stupid. So he never asked a bloody question for 4 years. And then Hamilton, he didn't perform. Hamilton cuts his ass. Yeah. And then Montreal picks him up, and then he's a backup quarterback under Tracy Hamm, is a legendary CFL quarterback. And in that moment, Anthony said, I knew at that point that I needed to step up and be mentored, and I needed to ask questions and let go of my fear of looking stupid. And in what you're saying, you were always willing to ask the questions, even as a gold medalist. You're willing to ask the questions to explore and to probe and to carry on a conversation about what you love. So I just wanted to share that story because there is something to vulnerability and asking questions, you know, and really being curious. So how does that sit with you in regards to your role now? And
makes me think of walking on the pool deck at Knox Grammar School. I'm 16 years old. I just arrived in Australia. I'm white as a sheet. Everybody's making fun of me because it's summertime there and I've come from Canada and I'm white as a sheet. And Chuck Arden, the coach, says, "What are you here for?" And I said, "Oh, I want to go to the Olympic Games. I want to represent Canada. I want to win a gold medal." And he says, "Right, mate, get in the pool." And I thought that I was going to be swimming with, I was 16, so I thought I'd be swimming with the 16-year-olds who were in lane six. And by the end of the very first practice, I'm in lane one with the 11-year-old girls from the sister school. And I'm just humbled, you know, it was just so humbling. But it was also, I was blessed because you know, Canadians have strengths and weaknesses, Australians have strengths and weaknesses. And by having a perspective of both, I was kind of able to be like, oh, wait a minute, you know, I can take this aspect of Canadian culture and approach, the apologetic, easygoing, whatever you want to call it. And I can take that little nuance, that little piece of Aussie, get in the deep end. Because I tell you what, when I was back in Canada, that same coach, not the same coach, but the same person in a certain role, that kind of role, didn't give the same answer when I said, I want to go to Olympic camp. They said, you sure about that? Like, you know, and that's very Canadian, very like, whoa, okay, why don't we just start with something small? Okay. And the Aussie was so typically Aussie, like, all right, mate, get in the pool. Like,
you got to do the work.
Go do the work. That's really me. And that piece right there, if I stayed in Canada, the story unfolds very differently.
Yeah.
It just doesn't unfold that way. It doesn't. I brought to sport that approach. And I tell you what, it got me in trouble too. You know, like that Aussie attitude also of Aussie, 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 got me in trouble because I came back to Canada and overplayed that a little bit. Come on, Mike, get in the pool. You know, and people are like, oh, wait a minute. Like, somebody's back. So that, that certainly made me think of that. You got to be vulnerable. You got to put it out there. I think that it's just with athletes, myself included, it's an attitude and love of doing. And that the results will just get in the way, you know? So it's this detachment from, it's figuring out in this fine line between, in your preparation, between having goals and aspiring and framing that in a way and giving yourself the ability to simply perform, not so much based on a place, but just the simple expression of yourself, expression of your gift. And that was, you know, my dad was very much on that. My dad was very much on this idea of like, if you're gifted, that's where you go express yourself. And that if you don't go express yourself in that manner, that's the loss. I really held on to that as I saw other athletes come along with great talent and no appreciation of the opportunity, bemoaning the opportunity. Mm-hmm. I can't be, this isn't fun. I don't like this. Oh my goodness. You have all that talent. You can't be bothered. Mm-hmm. That crushed me. And I really motivated myself on that. And that's a message I really give to our kids, Jenny and their mother and I give to our kids is go go express your gifts. And if you're afraid of things, go walk right at them.
Yeah. And I think of the power of visualization, and I just want to ask you a few more questions, but this story really stands out. And being Canadian, back in Canada for the first time in 3 years, being in quarantine, reconnecting with Canada, obviously Ron McLean is somebody, as soon as I hear his voice, I'm like, I'm back. Right. But I came across your video with him in July 2016, and you were interviewed on his As Maple As series, which was just a beautiful 3 minute snippet of the conversation. But in the interview, you shared an amazingly special experience. And for me, visualization, like, I've worked really hard in my life in sport and in other areas. And I really came across visualization about 10 years ago. And I've taken visualization in lots of different directions, but it's something that I really try to, when I say teach my kids, because one plays soccer, one plays golf competitively. And we sit and we try to visualize what success looks like, but we also try to visualize, not that you're visualizing failure, but you're visualizing how you're going to bounce back from failure, right? But when I think of your interview with Ron, there's a quote that I want to share. And I didn't know this about your story, but I'm going to share a quote from you. Then I have a question. And what you said in the interview was, it was 1993 and it was just announced that Sydney would host the Summer Olympics in 2000. After the announcement, as people were celebrating, I'm standing at Circular Quay, which is about 500 meters from Sydney Opera House, where I would go on to graduate from high school. I stood there at the start line for the Sydney Olympic triathlon that would take place 7 years later. I'm the first person there. I'm the first person to visualize. I believe that it is so critical to see in your mind's eye that which you want to produce, as is what we think we will become. That's all I thought about. And I believe there is magic there with that win. It's not just a coincidence. I think that story is so powerful because as a young person, maybe you didn't know it at the time that you were visualizing, because visualization really wasn't a big thing back then. But can you just take us through your process of visualization, whether it be your gold medal performance in Sydney, your 14 World Cup victories, 12 national Canadian championships? Talk about your process and your advice to anyone wanting to employ visualization in their life in order to improve their performance personally or professionally.
You know, it's funny you say that wasn't a thing back then. I've heard that since, and I've always thought, I thought everybody did that all the time. I remember saying, like, wait a minute, isn't everybody doing this? I really think it came from that Dungeons and Dragons. I go back to it. It's like, you're not, the story isn't scripted for you. You got to go build it. You're going to be able to picture all these different things. So you can have it. You have an intimate caricature of the avatar that you're playing, of the world that they exist in. And when you move on from there, you think like an ocean, you know, like you just think in this just really expansive way, because your mind kind of likes that. It's enchanted by that. And so when races are coming up, I remember running at Tarango Park Zoo, which is just in North Sydney there. It's the zoo for Sydney. There's this beautiful trail that runs around the back of it, and running along there and visualizing, picturing running with Miles Stewart, who was this great Aussie triathlete. I remember just like being so immersed in it that I was there. I was at this moment racing with him, and I was going to do this. And if he did that, and I came under this tree and I didn't see this branch on the other side, and took it right in the head, right on my back, like blacked out for a second, blood streaming down my face, running through this neighborhood in Sydney, the very posh neighborhood, blood streaming down my arm. And my buddy Dougie, he's like, what were you doing? Why didn't you notice that? I said, oh man, I was out sprinting Miles Stewart. You know, like I didn't see the branch. I just did that. It was all part of the prep. It's fun. It's like, yeah. That's the fun. And so for me, that's taken on different expressions over the years. But at the time, it was just this ability to really see and conceptualize and believe in.
Are you visualizing using all five senses? Because that's one of the things that I've read about, is that the tip of the arrow, the people at the tip of their craft visualize in a way that uses all senses. So it's not just right. Sight, but it's smell, it's sound, it's the tree branch hitting you in the forehead.
You know? Yeah. I think I did that. without knowing it, because I was often, it was during sessions. Each session at the pool was this opportunity to imagine being at the race and this, you know, and I often would recreate scenarios. So mm-hmm. we did a lot of scenarios training over the years, and it took a lot of pushing to do it. Yeah, there was a lot of resistance from the kind of the status quo to say, oh, come on, like, we're not going to do that. Let's just train. And I'm like, we are just training. What are you talking about? Like, I had the best swim of my life at the 2012 Olympics. And part of the reason was that Austin Horn, for the 3 weeks going into it, would swim beside me and run into me every stroke. And why did you, people say, why are you doing that for? I'm like, we just really got to get used to this. Like, this has to be I have to be able to see this scenario and know that I have I've charted the path. I spent a bit of time with Alistair Brownlee. He's a two-time Olympic champion for triathlon. He's just an extraordinary athlete, person, mind. Same thing. He's just always playing out the scenarios in his mind, figuring out all the different, well, if X is that, then that is that, then that is that. Right. And then he plays awesome. It out again. And that's why he wins. I mean, he just has courage. Jan Frodeno's the same. Nicolo Spirig is the same. I think that it's that there's a bit of vulnerability in that too, you know, to be able to. You got to be a bit out there. People say, well, sorry, what are we doing today? Oh, so this is Sydney. This is the course. That hill right there, that's the one, that thing. We're going to go up there and I want you to attack. Okay, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
And they don't, maybe in that case, they just become soldiers because they don't know, you know? I'm like, okay, well, I look back, I think maybe that was just the reason I was going to the race, and they were rehearsing the race to train, to help me train for it, is because they couldn't put themselves in it. And the analogy I've used since then is kind of a Netflix athlete versus the science fiction reader. The Netflix athlete needs the whole thing cast for them.
Yes.
They need to sit down. They need it played. Someone else wrote it, cast it, did all the direction, all everything. Yeah. And they just participated in as a viewer. They happened to be there, you know. And then those athletes, they come to the start line the day before, and they tend to come down there with the coach and they say, hey, coach, where's the swim? And the science fiction, the writer, the person who sees things in broad in like an ocean goes, well, but imagine it'd be right there. Imagine that would be the exit. That's the start. That must be the first buoy. That's the exit. That must go out. That's the exit. Where's the transition, coach? Well, I would imagine it's probably right there.
Yeah.
And that's not a coincidence that if you were to randomly pull out, okay, Ishigaki Jumi, 1997, what's the course? Okay, it's in the harbor. You come out, transitions on your left. You go left out over the bridge, up over the crest of the Blue Bridge, down the other side, turn around, back up, blah, blah, blah. I can do the entire course. I haven't been there for 20-something years.
Yeah.
Your mind just works in that manner. It's used to doing that. I think that piece right there unintentionally became my, superpower. And so that day in Sydney, and when Juan Antonio Samaranch says Sydney is the Olympic Games, not only do I sacrifice the moment of cheering, you know, to me that was important. Everybody else is cheering. And I'm like, no, the mission begins, you know, hyper dramatic. In my head, there are drums going off. There's I leave, all my friends are and I'm like, I gotta go over there.
Beautiful.
I go over there and I imagine that someone just ran over me and goes, hey, here's the map. I got it. And I get to go and just begin that visualization, and everybody is 500 meters from me just going crazy, and I'm alone on that spot, and I'm thinking, ha, nobody else has this advantage. This just is not repeatable. You cannot be Simon Lessing, who was the overwhelming favorite. He was not there. And so I felt like I grabbed onto that little piece. And I just ran with it, you know. It was like my little thing. I went back and visited that spot, and we would ride across the Harbour Bridge. And I was just a second, I gotta go. We were heading to South Sydney, and I was like, no. So we just gotta swim by the Opera House. It's a pain in the ass. Well, I'll see you there then. Go by. Go, there it is. There. Okay, cool. Back to the thing. That just paid off.
Well, what's so cool about that is it a grounded practice, or is it, obviously it wasn't a grounded practice then, it was something that you did naturally, as you said, that you were surprised that visualization wasn't a thing, and it wasn't a thing back then. You just did it through this imagination, this creativity, and just seeing it. And that's really a special skill to have that served you very well. And what I'm interested in, obviously winning the gold medal, you've probably been asked thousands of times, what was that like? Well, obviously it was joyous. I've seen your videos. It was a great Canadian moment, you crossing the line. I'm interested in the conditions that were present before the race. And yeah. And were those conditions purposefully designed? Or because, you know, in the CBC did a video, there's a video out right now about 6 minutes long that summarizes the race. And they said, oh, he was signing autographs. He was so relaxed before the race. Take us to the conditions before the race and what conditions were present, because the research clearly shows that performing at your best depends on the conditions beforehand. So that's what I want to know about. If you could take us through that, that would be brilliant.
I mean, I actually had a lot of my fear going forward to that. And I think what eventually was my undoing was that you couldn't replicate it. You know, I thought, wait a minute. So I need to find another scenario where all those things go in place. Like my 95-year-old grandmother was on the other side of the Harbor Bridge. My dad graduated from school right there. I went to the opera house as a 10-year-old and carved my name in bamboo in the botanical garden and ran by that in the race so many years later. My dad sat on his father's shoulders as a 7-year-old in 1950 at the Anzac Parade. And I passed the German, because the universe has a sense of humor. Yeah. I passed the German 50 meters from where 50 years earlier my dad sat on his war hero father's, my grandfather, Norman Whitfield, was a brigadier general in the Australian Army, went to 2 world wars, took his son to that spot. And 50 years later, his grandson ran by that spot and passed a German. Yeah, you replicate all that, like, for your next of everything after that. I was like, I don't really know how to weave all this together. So that actually, in hindsight, had a bit of a difficult, I struggled with that piece of it. Now, to answer your question, in terms of the conditions, we weren't intentional. We didn't need to be. We were just authentic to how we operated. Lance Watson was a new coach. He had some experience, but he's new to the Olympic Games. He's enthusiastic. He's so thrilled to be there. He doesn't have any baggage from it. He's just like, I can't believe I'm here. This is amazing. My best buddy, Jasper, comes over and trains with me there, you know? So I'm just like, wow, he's one of the funniest person you ever meet. He's just, we're having a great time. I'm in the Olympic Village. I'm like, I had this thing all through high school as a Nike ad that said, in my mind, I am a Kenyan. And there I am the day before the race, jogging on the little infield track at the Olympic Village. And the Kenyan team like starts jogging with me. And I'm like, oh, yes, of course you're here. You know, like, oh, this all makes sense now. Those little things just came together. And at the end of the day, there's the result, you know? And so in saying that, it makes it, we think, how do I replicate that magic? And you can't, you know, that you can't go, you can't manufacture it. It just, you get in a certain state of being and you love what you do and all those cliche things. And those things unfold.
Were you incredibly calm in that moment? Did you have that edge to you? Obviously you needed an edge to be able to start the race, but before we end the show, I just want to ask you that is like, what was your emotional state and your mindset in that moment before you, because you were on the outside, right? You were far outside left when you started the race.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, that's what Jenny and I aspire for our children, Tamara and I, my partner, we have 5 kids between us, and that's our message to them every time. And it's the same thing I'd say here is composure. I was composed. Mm-hmm. I had propriety of breath. And at the end of the day, you know, every Western you've ever seen, the one guy flinches and the other guy shoots him. It's every shootout you've ever seen. Propriety of breath. There's a great story about, it's called the heart sword. So if you think of martial arts or sword fighting is having 3 different forms, let's call it, like the flamboyant, like, you know, cha-cha-cha, the Antigo Montoya in Princess Bride. And, you know, it's very artistic. And then there'd be another heart sword fighting thing, let's call it medieval. You bludgeon each other to, you know, you just chop each other's arm. It goes and goes and goes and goes. And then there's a Japanese heart sword. You know, you stand in front of each other, the one guy flinches and the other guy chops him from heart through. There's no other action that takes place. And they may just stare at each other for 10 minutes and then the one guy flinches and they like a chops him in half. that right there, as ridiculous as that analogy as that is, that's composure, right? And so that's the message that in everything, and that more importantly in relationships, not racing, not all this silly run around speedo, but like that moment when your loved one and you are having trouble seeing eye to eye, do you maintain propriety of breath and maintain composure, or do you lose composure? Yeah. And my most shameful moments, those moments when my inner narrative is harshest on me, are always after I've lost composure. Mm-hmm. You know, so that would be that piece. That's the piece I try and give to our, which we try and give to our children. And that's the piece I try and give to myself. It's like, you know, being in a place through self-regulation and the stacking of good day with good day with good day. And the, like, that even keeledness is when I'm even keeled, I'm productive and collaborative and contributive. Yeah. When I'm not, I'm not.
And stitching those present moments together and maintaining the present moment and not ruminating about the past or projecting into the future. And that's a skill to be developed. And people think it's like you're born with it or you're not. No, it's a skill. Work on it. Reflect on it. You know. So, Simon, I have some quick hitters to end the show. And then I just want to, you know, have you share where people can find you. I know it's not hard to find you on social media or on the internet, but just some fun quick hitters to end the show. But your top song list that inspired you during your training sessions, top two, you know, two or three songs.
Hoxley Workman. He's my favorite musician of all time. He sings Anger is Beauty. Hoxley's just, if I was a musician, that would be Hoxley. He's from Muskoka, so not far from where I'm from. And we've become friends over the years. He heard an interview where I said Hoxley is my favorite on CBC, and he called. And I thought it was Adam Campbell. I said, yeah. Sure, you're Hoxley. And he's like, no, it really is. I was like, okay, Adam. So Hoxley worked with Anger is Beauty. The Tragically Hip went to the same high school as I did, and they were in the neighborhood, and they sang a song called Ahead by a Century.
Yes.
And you're ahead by a century. Yeah. And so I took that with me to Australia when I was a kid. I just, you know, the 100th meridian and Ahead by a Century. And then I'm going to go with, as an outlier there, but it's not to sound sophisticated. It's just cause it encapsulates one of my favorite moments by myself. Was Jordi Savall. He's a viola da gamba, deep cello. And we were training in Kona one year. I was living in a homestay way up on the in the coffee plantations. I was given the shed at the back of the property to, you know, it was like a tractor, a bed, and a dresser, and a bunch of coffee beans and a tin roof. And it would rain like nothing, like the roof was going to come down. And I would put Jordi Savall viola da gamba on real loud, and I would play it with the, like, I was like, oh man. So anytime that brings me back to there. So there are my three musics. Yeah.
Awesome. Which one, because I've now decided that I'm going to use the audio clip to one of those songs to end the podcast. Which one do you want?
Oh, it's gotta be Hoxley, just because it's a tribute to my friend. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to end the show with that one. The best book you've ever read that you want to recommend?
The Paper Menagerie by Ken Liu. He translated The Three-Body Problem, which would be my favorite series, The Remembrance of Past Earth by Cyan Liu. But Ken Liu's The Paper Menagerie and Other Stories, his quote, there is no clarity, there is only the will to endure and faith to live on. You don't need much more than that, right? Like, that's it. And so, if I could play Dungeons and Dragons with anyone, it would be Ken Liu.
Awesome. Great. Last question. You're 46 now? Are you 46?
Yeah. 46, yeah.
So, you know, I guess this is the typical question that you've probably been asked, but, you know, you're 46. So if somebody was to write a book about you at the end of your life, right? So they look at your whole life and hopefully you're going to live a long, healthy life until you're in your 80s or 90s. Maybe by then it'll be 110. Who knows, right? But being at your age right now, we're probably halfway through the book. So there are still some more chapters, right? When you think about those chapters, if you were to project 10, 20, 30 years from now, looking back, what do you want your legacy to be that you leave behind for your family, for up-and-coming elite athletes, anyone pursuing excellence? But what would those last chapters be about?
Curiosity. Yeah, that's probably it. He remained curious.
Yeah, beautiful.
You know, there you go. Yeah, I think like inquisitive, curious.
About that self, the world.
Not even about self. I heard this term recently, minimum self. What was it again? Minimal self. It was just this idea of like, we're so consumed now in our culture of who am I and what have I done and how do I feel? And I participate in that all the time. But it also is that source of all of our discontent, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
So we want to be these, we want to explore the meaning of all this. I would say that, yeah, that's it. Remain curious, played sport.
Yeah, but that curiosity piece is huge, you know, and by remaining curious, you open yourself up to people and new experiences, and new experiences are another door that you can walk through. And it's such valuable advice. And to end the show, I just want to thank Hugh Steele. You know, it was his birthday this week, so I want to say happy birthday to him. And I'm really grateful that Hugh introduced you and I, and that you could come on the podcast. And such a beautiful story you have. And it's not just about sport. It's about life. It's about so much more. And I really appreciate your time today, Simon.
Oh, thanks. I'll tell you a quick story about my cousin, Hugh. That side of the family, the Steeles, Nancy, Kaylee, Hugh, they brought to our family this that curiosity, that artistic element that we needed as a family. And one of my heroes is my cousin. I'm a big fan of Hugh too. My cousin Kaylee and the work that she does as a social worker is special.
Yeah.
It really is special. And if you ever want to talk about courage and compassion and patience and contribution, look no further than Kaylee Steele, who just epitomizes everything and all of those things. She's just the most incredible lady. How she, as a mom, as a contributor, as a cousin, the Steeles are special people. They, like I said, they brought a lot to our family.
Oh, that's beautiful. And Hugh actually has left his mark literally on my wife's body. So he's a tattoo artist, right? So.
I got my cousin.
Yeah, awesome.
I got a Chris Tucker wave with that my cousin tattooed, and it was just a fun time. It was like real connection after many years of being apart.
So, yeah, beautiful.
He's a good dude.
Simon, where can people find you? I mean, obviously they can find you just by putting your name in, but what is it that you want people to know about you, or where they can find you and what you hope they find?
So I do have a website, and if you go there and you can search around and find some musings, and it takes so much courage for people to write. And that's been my experience with it. It's so difficult. I turn on and off the section on my website that has some things I've written.
Yeah.
You can tell how I'm doing, cause I'll turn it on and off. Yeah. Like being very vulnerable. So I'll turn it off. But yeah, if you want, you go there, you could read there. And then
is it Relentless Pursuit, or?
That's our venture fund.
Okay.
My own personal website is just myname.com.
Okay.
That would be it. And I mean, if you did want to get to know me, that would be, go read the Three Body Problem and see what I'm into.
Okay.
That's it. Have you read that?
No, I haven't, but I will after this. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. There's books that blow your mind. That one just, that explained a lot to me. I was like, and on a big picture that he uses, big concept. What is great literature is universal meaning from specific incidents. He's the master of universal meaning from specific incident. And I just, that changed me profound. That book and that series changed me.
Awesome.
There you go.
Okay, great, Simon. I'm going to close out the show. Then I just want to say a couple words to you. Okay, so hey, Simon, thanks again.
Thanks for having me. It was a trip. I appreciate the time.
Everybody, thank you very much for listening to this episode with Simon Whitfield, and I hope you come back to listen to future episodes.